Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, live on this October 3rd evening. The weather has finally cooled down here from the all-time record-breaking hot summer that we had. We've even had a couple of nice rainfalls, but not enough to make a real dent in the devastating drought all over Texas. We would need about 2 weeks of steady rain, I think, to bring things back to normal, which we are not going to get. But we survive, and we can now enjoy the fall and winter, which, in my opinion, is the best time of year here, except for spring, of course. I have a guest tonight to help me talk about what I'm calling the culture of corruption. I think he's typing. This phrase reminds me of Kevin MacDonald's culture of critique that you're all familiar with. It's my thought that the culture of critique has given way to the culture of corruption, indeed led the way to it. I was thinking about Elie Wiesel and the culture of deception, theft, and lying that he personifies so well, and he is only one of many, many of his co-religionists who live according to such a culture. I was making notes about what to say and how to illustrate this for tonight's program when I read an article on the Christogenio.org website by William Fink, whom I know. The article, a long one, is titled Filthadelphia, and as I was reading it, I thought that it was the best thing I had read in a long time. I immediately asked Bill if he would come on tonight's program and discuss all the issues it brings up with me and with you, the listeners. So here he is, Bill Fink, the creator and maintainer of Christogenia. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Carolyn. Thank you. Yeah, you know, if a nation is going to survive, then its political spirit must come not only from a desire to fulfill its immediate needs, and that's what the Jewish media has, that's how they've been leading us around by the nose for the past 100 years, by manipulating our estimation of what our immediate needs are, and by constantly drilling into our heads that we need to satiate them. Rather, a nation's political spirit has to come from its common beliefs, its common culture, and the understanding of its national history and its common experience. Mm-hmm. The aliens in our society share very, very few of our beliefs in reality. They might claim to be Christians, or they might claim to be Americans, and at heart, they know nothing about Christianity or about America. And in terms of politics, they only understand their own immediate needs. And that's proven over and over again in the last 50 or 60 years of our history. In Philadelphia, and especially at the rather new National Constitution Center, the history of our nation has been drastically perverted. And it's very evident to anyone who knows history, who walks through the monuments and the tours given in the city, that is exactly what they're doing. They're creating a world by distorting our national history. They're creating a world that's safe for their own perverted multicultural agenda. And with the preponderance of Jewish monuments celebrating things like the Holocaust and even what little is left of our real history in Philadelphia is drowned out. In my Philadelphia article, my primary goal was to point this out and to investigate the causes and the motives which are behind those who are doing these things. And that's also the purpose for my Christogenia website. As a Christian, I claim that not my heritage from the Reformers or my heritage from the Catholic Church, of course, because that's not Christian at all, but from historical apostolic Christianity as it came to Europe nearly 2,000 years ago. And my Christianity comes from an understanding of the history of my race. And to me, that's important. Your beliefs and your understanding of your history have to be organic. They have to be to have evolved with the experience of your race, and they have to be congruent. If they aren't, then you're living a lie. And today in America, most people are living a lie, and they're living a lie because they simply don't know their history.
This bill is what I think is so powerful in what you present. And people probably know or should know that you are categorized as Christian identity. And I have never heard anything by Christian identity that really impressed me until I heard you. And I was quite surprised that I was being drawn into accepting some things that I had thought would be totally impossible for me to accept. So, and I think it is this clear connection that you make between our religion and our race. And, of course, in the problem with religions or problem with Christian religion is that it does not make any connection with race. And, in fact, it wants to be multiracial. And it became that, and this is a problem that so many white nationalists have with Christianity, but it seems to me that in what you bring together, and you are really quite the scholar, all people need to go to your website and see all that you have there. And this, you're not just blowing smoke, you're not just writing stuff that you don't know about, you really know. It's quite impressive, your scholarship, and you are self-taught, isn't that right? Kind of?
Well, I don't. I'm self-taught, right? I like to think that I learned from Strabo and Herodotus and Thucydides, sure. And I'm a student of the classics as well as the Bible, and I'm also a student of archaeology and a reader of all the journals and things like that. So I'm self-taught, but I mean, what we all have our
you're not a graduate from any of their schools.
No, and that's to my advantage.
More deeply. Yes, it is. Exactly. Yeah,
my advantage. The universities and the colleges are very superficial. It can be demonstrated in the books that they're producing and the books that graduates are producing. They're very superficial. That they don't, when they do get deep down into a subject, it's usually from a Jewish Frankfurt school type viewpoint where they're studying and making up stories, very subjective stories about the psychology of their objects and that they leave race out of the equation almost totally. Whenever race is brought into the equation of history, it's brought in to belittle the idea of race. It's the Jewish world that we live in, and they've had full control of academia for as long as they've had full control of our economy, which is at least since 1913. And it's a very corrupt and perverted world, and I'm happy not to be a part of it.
Yes. Well, you want to talk just briefly so that we can get into the article, but about how the Jews infiltrated the church it was way back in the beginning, wasn't it? How that all worked, not the church, but Christianity, how Christianity took the various forms that it's taken?
I would like to call them crypto-Jewish crime families. Basically, the Borgias and the De Medicis took over the Roman Catholic Church. That they basically usurped it through political influence and political control in the 15th century. And they are the cause the policies that they instituted are the cause of the Reformation. And scholars, Reformation scholars even, don't really look at it that way. But it was that's the reason behind the corruption of the Catholic Church. The Jesuits, the founding members of the Jesuits were almost all Jews. And the Jews had to, they were coming to a point where they were getting very wealthy from the noble families of Europe through their pandering, and they wanted to use their wealth to gain political influence, and they did that. The Jesuits were a primary vehicle by which they did that, because Jews at the time had no voice, and rightly so, in politics. They couldn't hold political office in most places in Christendom. They had no political voice and no public voice at all. And they formed the Jesuits so that they could get in to the courts of the kings and the dukes, and so that they could influence the church. And the Jesuits were their primary vehicle for doing that. And the Jesuits were behind many of the revolutions. The Jesuits and the Masons were behind many of the revolutions of Europe. Probably all of the revolutions in Europe, up through the Second World War.
Yes. It's that
now the Jesuits are minor players, and the Jews are basically out of the closet, right? And they do everything directly through their banking institutions and through the offices of government that they've infiltrated. So the Jesuits, I would say, are a very minor player now, but they were major players in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries.
Okay, well, let's. How does this fit with how? You know, it seems to me that through your story about Philadelphia, and tell us how you went there and why you came to write this article. But through what you've written here, you kind of show a general what could be applied all over the United States as to how the Jews took over to the extent that they now control so much in the United States, and that it was not meant to be this way. So many people like to talk about how the United States was founded by Freemasons and it was all planned that way from the beginning, and all of the founding fathers were Freemasons and so on. But you tell it quite differently than that.
Well, absolutely. The founding fathers were all Christian men. They were all good Christian men, with the exception of perhaps Thomas Paine and Alexander Hamilton. And it's I have many papers on my site that I researched and wrote myself, which proved beyond doubt from their own writings that Jefferson, Madison, Washington, Adams, John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin, that they were all good Christian men. They weren't church boys. Real Christians who understand their Bible know that the rites and the rituals and the pomp of the church are all anti-Christian. And the reformers didn't even successfully do away with a lot of that ritual. The corruption of American Protestantism by the Jew is another story. And we could probably hopefully get into that tonight. The Jews were already here when Pennsylvania was founded. If we research William Penn's papers, and the quotes are on my website, we will find that William Penn actually wanted to create a Christian empire in America, and he founded Pennsylvania as an exclusively Christian state. And the Pennsylvania of his time included New Jersey and Delaware, right? Well, Pennsylvania already had been infested with Jews. The Dutch had brought Jews over here with them. And the Jews had done very well in Holland. And it's actually the Jews that financed Cromwell. And that's why Cromwell allowed the Jews back into England when he took over the government. Okay, so this goes back pretty far. And Cromwell was a Puritan, and the Puritans have always been very wrong about the Jews, because the Jews aren't who they claim to be. Well, in fact, it was another Puritan. When the Reformation happened, the German reformers rejected usury. Usury had not been practiced by Christians, and it was barred from Christianity for over 1,000 years. The De Medicis in the 1500s, in the Fifth Lateran Council, forced usury on the Catholic Church and all of its bishops. Well, of all the reformers, the only two reformers that accepted usury that were major and had an impact were Calvin and Cotton Mather in Massachusetts accepted usury. And that gave the Jew the in here was the acceptance of usury. Well, the Jew was here with the Dutch. They were here in large numbers with the Dutch. There were large synagogues in Manhattan and Newark, New Jersey, and Philadelphia at a very early time. So it's very likely that the claims concerning the Jews that they were in Philadelphia when Penn was there, well, that's very plausible.
You do a good job of quoting from Wikipedia. The history of the Jews in Philadelphia.
Right, because when Wikipedia is, when they make an admission like that, I don't quote from them as a scholarly resource by any means. But when Wikipedia is willing to make such an admission like that, well, it's clear that it's true, because to me, that's not a very flattering admission. Right?
Yes.
And we expect Wikipedia, we as nationalists expect Wikipedia to be cunning concerning the history of the Jews. But when Wikipedia admits that the Jews were running the slave trade in the days of the Dutch, I could quote other sources on that, but that's why I quoted Wikipedia, because it's a shocking admission coming from a source that's very favorable to the Jews.
Yes, and it's really strong and powerful. I found that very interesting. And this is in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, that these Jews were operating in the 1600s and 1700s, becoming very strong, right?
Right, and it's very clear to me that the Jews were proponents, major proponents of the slave trade, until Christians... Yet, you know, the founding fathers, most of them spoke out against slavery. They didn't, even though they didn't care for Negroes much, and I understand that a lot of them owned slaves, they didn't see slavery as a viable and lasting institution. And Franklin and Adams, and especially the ones from the North, were all of that mind. Even though sometimes some of them owned slaves, they knew that slavery was basically wrong, and that it wasn't, and they believed they had religious beliefs. Many of the Christian peoples of the states who the slave owners were only an extremely small percent of the population, but many of the Christian peoples looked down on slavery, but real Christianity recognizes another man's property rights, even if that property is another slave.
Mm-hmm.
And real Christians would have never gone to war against their brethren over slaves. That's very unchristian, and that's beside the point. That the Christian slavery was looked down upon even by Christians of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. But once it became unpopular, and once it was done away with in many places, or it was being agitated, many of the Jews who had formerly been promoting slavery all of a sudden became its biggest opponents. Because if they couldn't have slaves, they wanted the Negroes freed, because free Negroes they could take advantage of and hire at lower wages. And it was the Jewish industrialists of New York and Boston that were the biggest agitators for the Civil War, or what is incorrectly called the Civil War, and the freeing of the slaves.
And so once again, the white man gets blamed for things that he really was being manipulated about.
Well, right. And most of the black slaves, what we have to remember is that the colonies of the South, the Carolinas and Virginia especially, they were started as commercial enterprises. Virginia was started as a commercial company, the Virginia Company. Uh-huh. And it was a commercial enterprise with stockholders in London who had the slaves brought over here purposely for the exploitation of their labor. The Carolinas were founded as a gift by Charles II to some of those who supported the Restoration, and those men also used that as a commercial venture and sought to gain profit. And most of the slaves, the original slaves, were in Virginia and the Carolinas, with the tobacco and cotton industries.
Okay.
Now the Jew in New York and Boston, where slavery wasn't very successful and where it was looked down upon by most Christians, they wanted to exploit black labor. And the best way they could do that is to free the Negroes from their Southern owners, which is brings us to the Civil War. After the Civil War, after the Federal Reserve, the institution of the Federal Reserve, and the Jews had become very powerful by that time. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that Jewish interests, once the Jewish Federal Reserve was instituted, and the Federal Reserve is a Jewish banking institute, once that was instituted, Jewish interests in our nation had gained the lion's share of the economic ability. They were the people getting the loans. They were the people who were, especially during the Depression, who were able to obtain loans to buy up large amounts of our property. And Philadelphia and New York are basically the first two centers of that I would call it treachery, right? But yes. The Jews of Philadelphia, when you look at Philadelphia today, all of the new monuments and all of the new money goes into the new museums are all Jewish or black. Mm-hmm. When you look at the Holocaust Memorial in the middle of the main avenue in Philadelphia, or when you look at the Holocaust Museum, which is brand new right across the street from Independence Hall. And if you look at the Jewish names, which are on certain edifices in the National Constitution Center, you can understand who is behind the corruption of our history. If you tour the National Constitution Center, you would think, not knowing anything about American history, you would think that the American Revolution was fought to free the black slaves. You would think the entire first 7 or 8 years of the history of our nation had nothing to do with anything except slavery. The exhibits at the National Constitution Center are all about Negroes. Whether it be the expansion of the West, it's told in the context of Negroes and slavery. Whether it be women's rights, it's told in the context of a similar oppression, as if women were being oppressed because they couldn't go vote. It's
Yeah. So when Americans or even other foreigners, Europeans or whoever comes and visits and goes to Philadelphia now for some time now to learn about the beginning of the United States and the Liberty Bell and all of that, what they're finding is a lot of stuff about blacks in the United States, African Americans, and the Holocaust and Jewish persecution all over the world and throughout history, and things like this. This is what they're finding. And your visits there, you make that so clear in your article. Tell us more about the city now and what you found. I thought it was impressive when you said that there are approximately 2,000 free Negroes living in Philadelphia, or was it in Pennsylvania? I think
Philadelphia was a bastion for
1790, and now it's by the end of the 19th century, 1900, it was 40,000, and now it's got how many are there?
Now
45% of the population. That's what you say here,
right? It's Philadelphia was always, because of the values of the Quakers and their attitudes towards slavery, their very negative attitude towards slavery, right? The Quakers, especially, of all Christians. Mm-hmm. The Philadelphia was always the center of black freedom in the North. It was always perceived that way. It was always a place that was very kind to Negroes and gave them every opportunity. And the Negroes never built anything there. They've done nothing but destroy. That they've done nothing but tear down, because blacks go, they bring Africa. That there's no doubt. And Philadelphia is the perfect place to see that, because that is where blacks have had equality, if you want to call it that, or at least political equality, right? for the longest period of time. That city, more than any other northern city, has been kind to the Negro, and the Negro pays the people of Philadelphia back by destroying the city. And that's all they do there. It's Philadelphia is a shambles. And right now, this year, there have been dozens of beatings of whites and flash mobs in Philadelphia where dozens of Negroes or sometimes even hundreds descend on white business districts downtown or on white passersby and innocent pedestrians and beat them and rob them. And it's been going on a lot this year. There have been at least half a dozen flash mobs in major cities across the country, but most frequently in Philadelphia have large crowds of Negroes been converging on a moment's notice. They do it through social networking on their cell phones beating and robbing whites and destroying white business.
We're going to have to go to the break now. We'll be cut off.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, Palestinian officials have accused the U.S. of putting pressure on members of the U.N. Security Council to keep them from voting in favor of a free Palestine. Analysts say that Washington is keen to be spared the embarrassment of having to veto the bid, which would be disastrous for its credibility as a peacemaker. RT's Marina Portnaya has more on the political complexities of the case.
It was a week-long gathering of the world's most politically powerful people.
The heart of the United Nations. The pursuit of peace in an imperfect world.
America's Nobel Prize-winning president set an ideal tone as the 66th session of the UN General Assembly opened. Yet at the heart of almost all diplomatic dialogue, demonstrations, and media attention was the Palestinian pursuit of official UN membership.
At a time when the Arab peoples affirm their quest for democracy, the Arab Spring, the time is now for the Palestinian Spring. The time for independence.
Supported by the majority of UN member states, President Mahmoud Abbas submitted an application for statehood. A historical bid the U.S., a staunch ally of Israel, vowed to block with a Security Council veto.
Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now.
As diplomats worked round the clock to bring Israel and the Palestinians back together at the negotiating table, delegations for 30 countries abandoned the Iranian president during his speech to the General Assembly.
If some European countries still use the Holocaust after six decades as the excuse to pay fine or ransom to the Zionists, should it not be an obligation upon the slave masters or colonial powers to pay reparations to the affected nations?
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's annual attack against the West and Israel was a reminder that
peace is hard, but we know that it is possible.
A possibility for the Palestinians and Israelis to resume negotiations was put forth by the Middle East Quartet Friday. Russia, the U.S., the European Union, and the U.N. presented both sides with a 12-month timetable to solve the 60-plus-year dispute.
Within 3 months of the negotiation beginning, to present comprehensive proposals on borders and security. That is the only way, in the end, we deal with the difficult issues around the table in a negotiation.
The UN General Assembly was this week's biggest political show, a spectacular display of pride for the Palestinians, a, quote, theater of the absurd for the Israeli Prime Minister. The Security Council meets Monday to discuss the Palestinian bid for UN membership. As the quest for peace goes on, divisions over how to achieve it remain firmly in place. Marina Portnaya, RT.
We'll be right back.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest is William Fink, whose website is Christogania.org, and we've been talking about his article, Philthadelphia. I love the title of that article, which is based on his two visits to Philadelphia last summer, in which he took photographs and made a lot of got a lot of impressions about the nature of the city and the multicultural aspect of Philadelphia. And we're going to go into that a little bit more now. You know, talking about the attitudes among white people that we have given away. Well, as you put it so well, we have, and we know, we have just plain given away our heritage, everything that, that we once had and that I think we deserve and we created. And we've given it away to what you call aliens or non-whites who are here either by the blacks through slavery or others who have just been immigrating here. And we're practically in an attitude of servitude to these people and also, feeling guilty and apologizing all the time. Our Congress is putting out apologies to this group and that group. And we're just, we're losing everything, and these people cannot keep it up. They can't maintain it. So this is a suicide that's going on, and that's why this article, which points out everything that we need to understand so well, is so important. So continue with the with this.
Well, the people that brought us the Federal Reserve, Jacob Schiff, Samuel Untermeyer, that they were New York Jews. They also brought us the Scofield Bible. Those people financed the Scofield Bible. The Scofield Bible is one of the most popular Bibles in American Protestantism today. It has been for a very long time, and that's because the Jewish publishers and the Jewish bookstore owners have pushed it and promoted it ever since Samuel Untermeyer financed it. And Cyrus Scofield was a member of the Lotus Club in New York City with Samuel Untermeyer and Jacob Schiff and a lot of the New York Jews, the bankers, and they financed the Scofield Bible. The Scofield Bible represents and has become prominent in use throughout American Protestantism, and that represents the best Christianity the Jewish money could buy. Second to that is the Bullinger Bible, also one of the most popular American Protestant Bibles. Bullinger got most of his notes from the Masorah of the rabbis. So his Bible is also very amenable to the Jews and helps promote the Jewish chosen people myth, when actually the Jews are, and it could be proven from history, that they are the people of the God's curses. And the Bullinger Bible, and Bullinger was a very good friend of Theodore Herzl, who's considered the father of modern Zionism. And the Bullinger Bible and the Scofield Bible have polluted American Protestantism, and they have caused American Christians to worship the Jew. So when the Jew moves his lips, the Christian bends over and does whatever the Jew wants. When the Jew sets when the enemies of Christ set the moral precepts in Christendom, we are in trouble, and that's what's been going on for 100 years. These Negroes, who had nothing but good done to them in Philadelphia for 150 years, in the 1960s started on a rampage of crime and violence that they've never gotten off until this day. That's how they pay the good people of Philadelphia back. Most of the whites have fled the city, and the Jews in Philadelphia have been moving in Chinese by the thousands. When I went to Independence Hall back in May, and I was standing in line, over half of the people in line to see Independence Hall were Oriental. There were many white, the whites that are left, right? That most of the whites that are left are sexual deviants, because Philadelphia has a huge area called the Gayborhood. And they boast about the neighborhood. It's a tourist attraction. They love the neighborhood so much, they put up rainbow street signs so that you know that you're in the neighborhood.
You have a couple pictures of that on this with this.
Yeah, yes, I do.
You said this is a large area. How large is this neighborhood?
Well, it's several blocks long. I mean, I didn't scope out the entire neighborhood.
Okay.
I just went in there to get my pictures of the street signs as soon as I heard about them, and I wanted out, right?
I'm amazed at this, seeing this, that the city would advertise this.
City advertised. That's Sodom and Gomorrah all over again. That's as bad as Greenwich Village. That's worse than Greenwich Village in New York, probably. The section, wherever you have Jews, you're going to have Negroes, Chinese, and sexual deviancy, and there you have it, because that's how they want to rebuild the world. And the Negroes... And their streak of violence for the last 50, 60 years, you know, Philadelphia has been kind to them throughout their entire history. Philadelphia has been a safe haven for Negroes and a center of black freedom in this country. I mean, I'm not bragging about it. It's just a fact of our history that Philadelphia is so much associated with that and contributed so much to freeing the slaves, right? For all that kindness, we're repaid with flash mobs of black youths beating up whites because of their race, even though the Philadelphia police are still denying that. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on. It's been going on for 50 years. It might be coming to a higher level now, it seems, this year.
Well, what does the attitude of the whites have to be to start turning away from this kind of masochism?
Whites have to realize that they and I wrote this on my Facebook page back a few weeks ago, and it's on my forum. Yeah, you know, we live in this global village, they love to call it. The liberals love to call this the global village, right? And we all live on the same cul-de-sac, you know, and the Mexicans are allowed to build fences. They're allowed to be Mexican and be proud of it. They have La Raza. La Raza is a Mexican racist organization that's actually receiving government funding under the Obama administration.
Yes, yes.
And it's a racist organization.
Mm-hmm. All non-white organizations that are racist, they all get funding because they need to catch up or something like that.
Well, whites have to get their lips off of the anuses of the Jews and realize that if we're going to survive, we have to be explicitly white. We have to have organizations that are not ashamed of being explicitly white and stating it. Because the Mexicans aren't ashamed of La Raza, they're proud of it. The Negroes aren't ashamed of the NAACP. They're not ashamed of their all of their black colleges that only blacks attend and teach at and get government funding. That's mm-hmm. racist. They're not afraid of the EEOC. They're not ashamed of the EEOC. They're not ashamed of affirmative action. They're not ashamed of the special favors they get for being black. But that leads me to discuss the welfare state. A lot of people blame the welfare state for the violence of the blacks, but the violence of the blacks started before the welfare state got off the ground. The welfare state was created to appease the blacks, because wherever man wants to defy nature, he has to build an infrastructure to support the defiance of nature. If you want to go up in space and float out in space, you need a $3 billion space station to support you. Well, if you want to defy nature by integrating society, you need a multi-zillion dollar welfare state to support it. Without the welfare state, the society falls apart because its components are not equal and can't adhere to one another.
Well, that's excellent, and let's elaborate on this a little bit, because we can't hear this enough. Now, if you this idea that it's we're doing what's unnatural, and liberalism is all based the kind of liberalism I'm thinking about is all based on this idea that nature is too harsh, too cruel, and we're going to make things better for everyone. And we're going to do things in a kind way, and so this is the result of it. And this is a mistake. But how do I think people have to become very, very racially aware and racially believing in race, and which most people, most white people don't and are not. They've been, we've been indoctrinated against it. But until we do this, we don't have what it takes to do the things that are necessary to stand up for ourselves in the way that's necessary.
Well, to me, racism is love. Racism is a love for your brother, and it's a love for your God, because God is the author of race. Even if your God is the God of evolution, which to me is a Jewish God, your God is still the author of race. If you believe in evolution, evolution is the author of race.
Yeah,
and racism is love for God's creation. So it doesn't have to be couched in solely Christian terms, even though I would prefer to couch it in solely Christian terms. God is the author of race. I know he's the author of my race. And therefore, for me to be a racist, to be racially aware, is to love my brother and the creation of my God.
Okay, so we have to correct that love should be to our, love is supposed to be to our own family, our own kind, our own kin. It's not to be for everyone. And this is where the Christian teachings have gone way off the beam, right?
Well, because they've spiritualized brother. But I have news for them. There's no such thing as spiritual sperm.
Okay.
When the promises went
but
to
there's no, yeah, well, spiritual brothers makes a whole lot of sense to a whole lot of people.
Well, the Greek word brother means siblings of the same mother. That's what the word means literally. Adelphus, that means to come from the same Delphi or womb. The Delphi is the letter D, but it was used to represent the matrix or the womb. That's where the word comes from. That's how it was understood in Christian times. I mean, I could go to great lengths to demonstrate that right from the New Testament.
Well, I think so. I think, yeah, that the whole idea of who is our brother and who is meant by love one another and love your, what are some of those things that are translated in the Bible? It doesn't mean everyone, but it's come to mean that. That's the way the churches are teaching it.
The Hebrew word neighbor comes from a verb which means to graze together, to be a part of the same flock.
Okay.
That's what it means. And
that's like a tribe or tribalism, and tribalism has gotten such a bad reputation.
Well, tribalism is microcosmic racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's racism on a slightly smaller scale. I mean, you would prefer, if you were Irish, you would only prefer Irish people, and to hell with the Swedes, right? But the Swedes and the Irish have ultimately the same origin, so they should care for each other, and they should care for each other's nations, because a strong Sweden and a strong Ireland is a strong Northern Europe, right? I mean, it's...
Okay, but where do we draw the line? And we have to draw the line at race, right?
Well, that's the only place to draw the line, and that's where the Bible draws the line. That the Adamic race is the white race, and that could be established in history. All of the descendants of Noah were white. It's absolutely crazy to think that any of them were non-white. It defies nature, and God, the God of the Bible, is the God who said 10 times that everything should be kind after kind. Everything after its kind. That word kind can just as easily be translated species or race. And that's one of the primary laws of God. And that's a law of God not only in the Old Testament, but in the New. Because Paul says in Hebrews chapter 12 that we're either sons or bastards. The Greek word bastard is nathos, and it's used only in connection with being a half-breed.
Well, is there a way to teach this? Is there a way to help white people get tougher and understand the consequences of their foolish friendship with all kinds of other races in the world? Is there a way to do this without going into so much biblical terminology?
Well, there's a way to do it perhaps to people that aren't trained in the secular and in the mainstream churchianity religions. Well, these people trained in the mainstream churchianity religions, these issues are all the issues that they're going to bring up because they've been taught that the words in the Bible don't really mean what they meant to the Greeks, which is just crazy. Yet, you know, to a Greek, sperma was what came out of a man and created children. It wasn't something spiritual. It was never anything spiritual. Your sperma are your offspring, period.
And now it supposedly means something spiritual?
Well, yes. They believe that you could become one of the sperma by professing a belief when the Bible actually teaches that if you are one of the sperma, you will one day profess the belief.
Okay, well, this brings us to the opposition to the racial idea, which is that people can switch around and join other groups because they are in agreement with them or something, or they feel like they are sympathetic with those ideas, whatever. And you can cross these racial barriers. How do we teach people? Is there any way other than what is in the Bible as the Word of God?
No, nothing in the Bible ever suggests.
No, but is there a way other than that to get white people to understand the racial idea and how important it is?
Well, it's simply a common sense look at history. Look at every one of our cities is destroyed. What was ever created in China? Mm-hmm. That the only thing that the Chinese have ever created was filth and confusion. All of their cities are massive conglomerates of filth and confusion.
What about the supposed great Chinese civilizations, the Ming and the...
The Chinese civilization of what, 2,000 years ago? That they were white. A lot of them were white or were influenced by whites or influenced by Arabs. That if the Chinese had ever created a great civilization on their own, where are their monuments and why don't they have it now?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with the others I can see very clearly, in the Middle East and so on, where, you know, what people did at one time, these great civilizations, why can't they do it now? Well, it's clear to me that they're not the same people, that they were white people.
Well, the Islamic civilization was a great civilization until when? The 1100s? Well, what happened in the 1100s? By the 1100s, the preponderance of white blood had been mixed.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about this horrible idea of mixing all blood up, and so that we're all the same, and some people come up and some people go down, and then we don't have these differences?
I've taken to calling that universalism. The original rebellion of the Bible was a sin against blood and race. The original rebellion of the Bible was race mixing. The original fall of Adam in the garden was race mixing. Genesis 3 describes a race mixing event. I have papers on my website which take Akkadian literature, which was contemporary and used the same idioms in a very similar dialect, and proves that Genesis 3 is the description in poetic terms in a parable of a race mixing event. And Genesis chapter 6, which precipitated the great flood of Noah, which was not a worldwide flood, it was a local flood, also describes a race mixing event. And most mainstream churchmen accept Genesis 6 being a race mixing event, and Genesis 3 they reject, which is to their discredit. The rebellion against God is the destruction or the corruption of his original creation. And the Jews,
a lot of people are not going to listen to this. You know, they're just not prepared to listen to this.
Well, no, they're not. But if we see who in today's society is the major proponent and the major force behind race mixing, the destruction of borders, the destruction of nationhood, we see the Jew everywhere.
Yeah. So they know that. So they're promoting that, as they know that is the most damaging thing that they can do, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And,
And so we need to know when all this nice sounding talk comes up about how we need to get along with everyone. And, some Jews are good Jews and we can bring them into our organizations and so on. Well, they might be, but you still have to keep the lines very clearly drawn, or pretty soon, just like with this country or any countries, you see that if you let down your guard to a certain extent, pretty soon the gap gets wider and wider, and your whole, pretty soon your nothing is the same as it was. It's gone too far to come back.
Colonial ancestors would be ashamed of us. The word posterity means all of one's descendants. That's what posterity is. And the Constitution, when it was written, I'd like to read three lines from the preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. John Quincy Adams, and I quote this in my Philadelphia article, and I have all of the historical supporting documents on my Christogenia website. John Quincy Adams, in his speech that he gave on the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Constitution, he admitted in his speech that it was moved, speaking about the Constitutional Convention, that in determining questions, each state should have one vote for every 50,000 white inhabitants. Why would John Quincy make such a racist remark? Because John Quincy Adams understood what posterity meant. And if you go against that, then you are unconstitutional. Any court that rules against the opening lines of the Constitution is an unconstitutional court. And people didn't care about that 100 years ago. And I think it was simply because they couldn't foresee a great white nation being overrun with aliens. They had more sense than that. Well, because they didn't foresee it, here we are.
Well, we didn't even foresee it in the 50s. You know, I mean, we just didn't foresee what these measures that were taken in the 60s were going to bring about for us in just a few short years.
Well, I'm too young for the 50s, but I saw it in the 60s.
But you know about it. You know about it, right? I mean, well, this is where already in the 50s people had no idea, but in the 60s, when they said, oh, well, we have to be nicer to all these people, they didn't foresee it. But that's when it started, and it has moved so fast since then.
Well, that's because the Jew has perverted our history. And if you go to Philadelphia, you could go to the National Constitution Center, you won't see anything about the Constitution. The only connection they really have there to the Constitution is one room with several dozen bronzes of some of the founders. And they're bronzes. They're very dark. So that way, they're basically racially ambiguous. And a lot of those bronzes, they're bronze statues, life-size bronze statues, a lot of them have large hooked noses.
They put those in there? They left those in and took away the others or something?
They made up these bronzes and put them up like it was a real convention room with all the signers of the Constitution in it from the various states, but they're bronzes, and
mm-hmm. So you can't see the color. Yeah, yeah.
You don't know that the nation was founded by all white men.
Yes.
You know.
Well, we have a lot of paintings like that, and you know, then people will say, people believe today that they'll say, well, all those our founding fathers, they were racist. You know, and yet it's true they were, which was a good thing.
We
need to see it as a good thing, but instead we're being taught to see it as a bad thing, and that we have to correct what they did wrong, and they're the founders of the nation.
That they left this nation to their posterity, meaning the descendants of them and the people, the white people who they represented. And 50 years later, John Quincy Adams recognized that. When he said that at the Constitutional Convention, it was decided that there would be one congressman for every 50,000 white people. That's what he said specifically in 1839. That's what he said.
Well, we're almost ready for our top of the hour break, after which we will come back and have call-in opportunities for you. The phone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 1-855-477-2283. So if you want to talk to Bill about any of these things, then you call in once we get started at the top of the hour once again. Now, but when we do get started again, I want you to talk a little bit about this guard and these guards at the Independence Hall, the National Constitution Center, and the kind of tours they give and the kind of things they talk about. It's really, it's so interesting to me. All right, we will be back, ladies and gentlemen, in about 5 minutes. So stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Sandra Gottman with the latest world news. The U.S. Senate is expected to approve a procedural vote aimed at fast-tracking a new law designed to punish China for manipulating its currency. Supporters of the bill say it will help redress the huge loss of manufacturing jobs. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
In the context of unemployment above 9%, this legislation is supported by a majority of Republicans and Democrats in the Senate, and will allow the U.S. to impose countervailing duties on imports from countries whose currencies are deliberately undervalued. Supporters of the bill say China's manufacturing sector has long benefited from Beijing's control of the renminbi to the detriment of American jobs. But many in the business sector here argue that these actions would only have limited actual impacts in the U.S. and risks inflaming trade protectionism between the two nations and globally. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
Thank God Britain did not join the euro, according to UK Chancellor George Osborne addressing the Conservative Party's annual conference in Manchester. Britain's finance chief told the Tory faithful that Britain's European neighbours had plunged headlong into the euro without ever thinking through the consequences.
Our European neighbours plunged headlong into the euro without thinking through the consequences. How could they believe that countries like Germany and Greece could share the same currency when they had vastly different economies and no mechanism to adjust? For generations to come, people will say, thank God Britain didn't join the euro.
But he said a solution to the current debt crisis would be the single biggest boost to Britain's economy. In a speech widely seen as a bid to sound upbeat, the Chancellor also pledged to support small businesses through credit easing guarantees, freeze council tax for another year, and invest in British manufacturing and science. Amanda Knox, the American woman convicted for the murder of UK student Meredith Kircher in Italy in 2009, has appealed her jail sentence of 26 years at a court in Perugia. Her former ex-boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, has also appeared, denying accusing Amanda Knox of murder. The appeal hinges on a review of the DNA evidence of a knife believed to be the murder weapon. The evidence is now under scrutiny for potential flaws. Amanda Knox told the court she had been betrayed and manipulated.
The people don't understand who I am. You can sit down if you wish. Okay. I am the same person I was 4 years ago. The same person. The only thing that is different from 4 years ago is...
Thank you.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, for the second hour of the Heretics Hour tonight. My guest is William Fink of the website Christogenia.org, a fascinating website which has got more on it than you would ever. It would take me, I think, a year to find it all and really read it, let alone study it. So, and he's got tons of podcasts. He does regular podcasts, two a week generally, and he puts everything on. He goes, does guest appearances too, and everything is on his website somewhere. And so there's a lot of good listening there. And of course, as you've noticed, Bill is a very good, he speaks very clearly. And he made this, in this article, Philadelphia, he made it all so clear, so many things so clear. And what I'm trying to pound on tonight is the culture of corruption. And we've been talking about how much corruption has taken place in these once great United States of America. And, you know, I have been a critic of the United States, bad critic. But I realize that a lot of that is based on stuff I just keep hearing and, a kind of a liberal background. And I'm just cleaning myself out from all of this. And what these alien peoples bring, wherever they go, when they go into white countries, they bring corruption of one sort or another. What would you say about that, Bill?
Well, when you look at the nations that they came from, that is what they are capable of building.
Yeah.
The capabilities and the civilizing spirit of the white man allows the white man to create beautiful societies no matter where he is, whether he's in South Africa, where he had a once beautiful society that's being destroyed right now by blacks and Jews, or whether it be Australia, which is a barren wasteland. And Australia was a prison colony. Mm-hmm. The people that the English considered the scum of society were dropped off in Australia. And it became a great nation. Those people, they were white, and their descendants built a wonderful nation in a hellhole. Where there's all kinds of tarantulas and giant snakes and all kinds of heartache and with the weather and the arid climate and the deserts. And it's a terrible place, Australia. I mean, if you had to pick a spot on the globe to live, it probably wouldn't be Australia. But these people built a wonderful society there and a vibrant nation. Where the blacks that were the aboriginals that were there before them never built anything. The Africans, the blacks in Africa, never built anything. They don't live by the spirit of God, for sure. They don't live by the rule of law. They only live by the law of the jungle, and they take that wherever they go. In the United States, white society was defined. The word man was defined for centuries as white society. And that's why the Negroes in the 60s said, look out, here comes the man. They meant the white police. They have no respect for white laws. They only have remorse when they're caught because they got caught. They have no remorse for their crimes ever. And their whole purpose is to
defeat. Well, that's true. In fact, they take everything and make themselves victimized by it. Did they learn that from the Jews, or do just all these people have this same trait to do this?
Well, they're considered victims. If you send a black man to prison for 10 years for a crime that he did, he considers himself a victim of your system because he does not have the same values. He rapes a woman. He doesn't care for the woman. To him, he did something perfectly legitimate because he was bigger and stronger than that woman.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets caught, he's only upset that he might go be punished for it because he feels that it's unfair to be punished for it. That's the mind of the black man. I've seen it up close and personal for 25 years of my 50 years of life. Well, actually, probably a lot more than 25 years.
Well, you as has often been said, those people who never have any experience with black people or with Jewish people, you know, a lot of Jewish people, which most of us have never been around, a lot of Jewish people, or any other people, have this have a sympathetic attitude toward them. But people who have really experienced being around them in real life situations don't have that sympathetic attitude. I'm going to give out the number one more time here. It's 1-855-477-2283 if you want to call in. Do go ahead and call. We'd like to talk to you. Okay. So it's so right that, and people, if, like you say, the whites have fled from Philadelphia, which is now 45% black or something like that.
Jews are replacing them with Chinese and with other aliens.
Okay.
And they're rewriting our history to make it safe for these Chinese and other aliens. One of the things that we saw, and this is why, this was the primary reason why I went back a second time, was because the first time we were on a tour, and I didn't record it, and I hated myself for it later, the tour guide actually said that Pennsylvania was founded for the religious freedoms of Jews, Christians, and Muslims.
Yeah.
That's what they're teaching at Independence Hall.
Well, that sounds familiar. I mean, it's not surprising to hear things like that. It's so crazy.
This tour guide said that Pennsylvania was founded for the religious freedom of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. That's what he said verbatim. And I would like to read, it's only a couple of short lines, that this is from B.F. Morris. It's a book written in the 1860s about the Christian founding of our colonies. And B.F. Morris, this is a very scholarly book. I did a three-part series, which one part included the outtakes from this book exclusively. And B.F. Morris says that the first legislative act passed at Chester, that this is even before Philadelphia was the capital, right? Chester is a large city a few miles south. The seventh day of the 12th month, December 1682, announced the ends of a true civil government. And he said that the preamble of the legislative act said that whereas the glory of Almighty God and the good of mankind is the reason and end of government, and therefore government is in itself a venerable ordinance of God, and for as much as it is principally desired and intended by the proprietary and governor, meaning William Penn, and the freemen of Pennsylvania and territories thereunto belonging, to make and establish laws as shall best preserve true Christian and civil liberty. Yeah. And Pennsylvania was purposely founded as a Christian state, but with no mention of Jews or Muslims. It was, and it goes on to say, in opposition to all unchristian, licentious, and unjust practices. And I'm just outtaking from the law, but that's what it says verbatim. And that was the first.
Well, you know, Christianity has such a bad rap now. I mean, so often people think of people who aren't Christians.
Because it's
a lot of them who don't. Because they say, oh, well, you know, Christians are all hypocrites. They're warmongers. They're this, they're that. And so, you know, we just take in this kind of stuff. And so when we read about the Christian principles that this nation was founded on, we think of that as being racist and discriminatory and all this stuff. Well, Bill, we have a couple callers. So let's take our first caller. I believe it is Russ. Hi, Russ.
Yes. Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I really respect William Fink. I think he's an outstanding scholar, extremely interesting man. Really enjoyed listening to the conversations that the two of you have had over the last several weeks, including this one tonight. But I have to ask Bill, on an emotional level, whether he really believes that in the Torah that God ordered a group of Israelites to stone a man to death for gathering wood. And if he does so believe, why would he worship such a being who would order such a heinous act to be committed on an innocent man who was simply gathering sticks.
Okay, let Bill answer. And let's try to get through this so we can get to our other caller, too.
Well, there are examples for us that are more important in this world that will, and if you're a Christian, you believe in a life in the next world. And all of the examples that we live in this world and the things which we learn are for a reason. And they are to, so that we understand that God and his laws are sovereign and that there will be no more rebellion against God. And the people that wonder at such laws, that they really give too much, that they place too much importance on life in this world and not enough in the next. That the first thing that man has to learn is that God is sovereign, this is his law, and there are deep reasons why we are to obey it.
And may I take exception with what you've just said, Bill?
Sure.
What you're saying is that we should not worry so much about what goes on in this world, but to worry more about what goes on in the next one. I think that's a big mistake. I really do. We're being constantly told that, for example, Rick Adams and these other jerks saying that...
Don't keep bringing up RBN, Russ. VOR really doesn't have much connection with people on RBN.
Well, no, it does, because it's this religious nonsense that we shouldn't worry about what goes on today. We should rather think about God and what the afterlife and all of this nonsense. I think we should worry about what's going on today rather than...
Well, Bill, I think...
Well, you're taking my comments out of context. I mean, in relationship to his law, we have to understand that God is sovereign. If he tells us not to do a certain thing, there is a good reason for it. If his judgment is condemnation, it's for our learning, so that there won't be any further rebellion from God.
All right, I think Russ, I want to thank you for your call. I don't want this to get into a long, drawn-out religious debate. You can always write to Bill and talk about these things and probably call him, too. So we're going to thank you. Thank you, Russ. I don't want to get the conversation off track here. So do we have another caller? You want to put on the other caller? Well, said he had one. Is anybody there? All right, I will give out the phone number one more time. 1-855-477-2283. Mike said there was another caller, but I don't see him coming on. So, Bill. You were talking about this tour guide in the building there and what he was saying. Oh, here she is. All right. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question, for Bill. Now I've just become Jew wise myself, and it kind of makes sense how the Jews were behind the African slave trade to begin with. And they were also behind the NAACP, which gave them equal rights. And obviously Karl Marx being a communist, this will cause a feeling of jealousy between the two races that are clearly not equal. They're not equal in the field of anthropology, but yet we're supposed to believe we are. And what I want to know in particular, naming names of the Jews that would not allow these Africans to go to Liberia after the Civil War, because Liberia was purchased for that reason. And it's ironic to me that they were not able to return, and instead the NAACP was formed. And then we had the forced integration after the Brown versus the Board of Education. And so I just want to leave it at that. I just want to get some names of the actual Jews behind the hindrance of these Africans being returned to Liberia. And I will let you go with that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. So what do you say, Bill?
Well, I'm very familiar with the early 1800s and the fact that there was a large movement to repatriate freed blacks to Liberia. And they even, James Monroe, for instance, was a large proponent of the movement, and they named the capital of Liberia after him for that reason. But I don't know the actual names of the people behind it. That's not my area of general study, right? My area of study is actually pre-Christian history and ancient Greek classics, and even that is a pretty detailed question and probably not very fair, since that's not the purpose why I'm here tonight, right? It's not our primary subject tonight, right? So I really can't answer that question. I'm not prepared for it.
Well, I would say, you know,
it's a good question. It should be posted on one of my forums, and I'd be glad to research it, right?
Okay.
And maybe I will.
You know, I think the whites who wanted to free the slaves, well, the whites who were backing up the blacks so much, led by Jews, they did not want the Jews to to be sent back to Africa. Right?
No, because the
and
Jews.
So there was only some blacks who wanted to, but then they talked the rest of them out of it. And you know, blacks had it so good here. Why would they want to go back to Africa? This is what's so ridiculous about this idea of how badly what we did to them by bringing them here as slaves. Not a single one hardly would ever go back, and not unless you bankrolled them.
Well, what's really amazing is that they can't go back, and the American Negro knows it. And there's a book written on this topic. The African blacks despise Negroes. And Negroes are properly, or mulattoes, right, properly mixed blacks that might have some white blood or some Jewish blood usually or something else in them, aside from that of their original tribe. Well, the African tribes, and I'm speaking like the Hutus, the Tutsis, the Mandingos, all of these people, they recognize each other.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they despise anybody. They are extremely tribal. They are extremely racist. And the American Negroes, Liberia was carved out of Africa for a reason. Because the American Negroes can't go back to any one of those tribes because they're all mixed. Mm-hmm. And they know it. And there's a black man who's written op-eds to the Wall Street Journal, educated black man. His name is Richard Patterson, wrote a book on this very topic. The title of the book is Out of America.
Okay. Well, so we were going to protect them in Liberia. Is that right? We were going to send them to Liberia. And I know money was put there and they were building all kinds of stuff. And all these American Negroes were able to go there. But how are you going to keep Liberia functioning against all those blacks who hated these mulattoes?
Well, you can't. When the blacks in Haiti had their uprising and killed all the whites, they killed all the mulattoes, too.
Okay. Yeah, well, there you go. I understand that. Now, so what can be done about the American blacks since the Africa? You can't send them to Africa. They can't go to Africa because they're not really African anymore.
My personal belief, and this isn't really eschatological. I'd rather not get into my Christian eschatology here. However, my personal belief is that if you stop feeding the Negroes with the white man's money and the sweat of the white man's labor, which is what the welfare state does, and push these people into their own communities, that then they will have to either work or die. And is that inhumane?
I don't think so. You know, you're right. That's exactly the attitude. This is, I say, the attitude that whites cannot come to because of liberalism has caused them, they get into this philosophy that it's our responsibility because we have superior abilities to take care of all these people. But as I was going on and on last week about the Somalians, you know, you can't do it because, they just keep breeding and they just keep growing and your burden keeps becoming worse and worse. And so this, let nature take its course. Yes, let them work or starve to death. I mean, this is why I say we have to be hard. We have to know how to be hard enough. Otherwise, we're just going to be destroyed.
Well, one of the things I mentioned in Philadelphia is the children that we could have had if it weren't for the welfare state. The children that we could, before the welfare state, at the peak of World War II, the average American paid 20% of his income in taxes. In the 1950s, at the middle of the Eisenhower administration, the average American paid about 5% of his income in taxes. With the institution of the welfare state, that is totally that has gradually crawled up to 50%, and now we pay a large amount of property taxes and things that were unheard of in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And tons, thousands and thousands of little hidden taxes. A gallon of milk might be taxed 4 or 5 times before the consumer puts it in his refrigerator. And all of these things support the burgeoning or the blossoming, I can't pronounce the word, I'm sorry, the blossoming Jewish bureaucracy in our governments.
Burgeoning.
Burgeoning. And every year, the government employs tens of thousands more people than it did the year before. And that's not only at the federal level. That's at every level, state, county, municipal. When I was a kid, I remember my freshman year high school algebra class had 60 kids in it. It was a double classroom in a Catholic school, but we all learned.
Mm-hmm.
In my school here in this town, in my school district, the average size classroom is 12 kids. And the small classroom, I mean, when I was a kid in school, in grade school, every classroom had 25 or 30 kids.
Yeah, sure.
But we learned because we had discipline.
And we were well behaved. That's right. And everything was organized and we all got along. I mean, it was wonderful compared to
now. Integration has brought our educational system to the water
seeks
level, and it's chaos. It's at its lowest level now. We had the greatest educational system in the world. Integration has destroyed it because the Negro does not have the culture to engage in an education system like ours, and there were very few, and the total percentage of Negroes, a very small percentage of them, can eclipse that and do well. Most black entrants into U.S. colleges drop out. It is a statistic that the media doesn't really play up or doesn't even really mention at all, but most blacks going into four-year American colleges drop out before they finish, no matter how many grants and scholarships they get, and they just can't hack it, and they don't have the intelligence, and it's pulled our race down, and now our kids act like Negroes.
Well, Bill, we've got a call from Frank. I think we'll take that now so he doesn't have to stay on in case we lose him. We're going to go to the break in about two and a half minutes or so. But hello, Frank. Welcome.
Oh, good evening. How's everybody doing?
Very good.
I wanted to weigh in on one thing. Bill, you're spot on with what you just said. When the civil rights movement really took root and integration became the order of the day, or forced integration, even the black communities fell apart. You'll talk to some blacks now that are in their 70s or 80s, and if they're honest, they'll make the statement that they were actually better off in many ways before the civil rights movement. They had communities that were their own, schools that somewhat functioned. I mean, they were separated from the white society, but their quality of life was still better because, in a lot of respects, they tried to emulate what was going on in the white society.
They had better morals too, didn't they? They were more moral people.
Look at the illegitimacy rate. I think it was. In the black community, it was always high compared to the white side. But I mean, now it's like almost 80% of black babies are born out of wedlock. I mean, the white races, to some extent, they're following a bad example with this too. But it's still not percentage still isn't quite there.
Well, if our law is imposed on them, as it was up and through the 1950s, that they can cope with that, and even though they constantly had problems, and they were still, most of our prison cells were filled, you know, much more were filled by blacks than whites, even through the 1950s. But that they still can't live by the rule of law that we can, and they still rebel against it. And inside of their own communities, they contain their problems within themselves a lot better. And I still wouldn't say that they were actually, I wouldn't go far as so far to say that they were actually with the moral model that most white suburban communities do, because they certainly didn't.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Eurozone leaders are preparing a rescue plan to prevent the escalation of the financial turmoil threatening to send the global economy back into recession. This comes as the IMF has warned it may not be able to help out bigger European economies struggling to tackle their debt. With a Greek default now widely considered just a matter of time, the priority is to keep bigger states like Italy and Spain from being dragged down. Greece has been hit by another wave of protests against government austerity measures, but as RT's Ganesh Chikian reports, the IMF is accused of being too tough on some countries while being too soft on others, like the U.S., where the crisis began in 2008.
The leadership has changed, but the methods have not. For a desperate economy, the IMF still offers the same bitter medicine of draconian budget belt-tightening. Greece is pushed to redouble its austerity efforts at a time of deep economic recession and to sell a vast chunk of public assets at fire sale prices.
Some have no choice but to cut deficit now.
The IMF's former head, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, said that forcing Greece to pay back its debts would unacceptably impoverish the country, and that everyone must be willing to accept losses on Greek debt. But philanthropy has never been the IMF's strong point.
It's an institution where my main shareholder is the United States of America. Well, any dollar, any euro that is invested in the fund goes back to the member, principal and interest. We're not in the business of subsidies. We're not in the business of giving grants.
The U.S. and Europe are holding the most votes in the organization and veto power, despite the fact that emerging economies have been the engine of global growth in recent years. The organization's policymaking has been under fire for being biased in favor of its top shareholders. One of the functions of the IMF is crisis warning and prevention. But when 3 years ago the financial crisis in the U.S. was sending devastating shockwaves throughout the world, the organization proved completely redundant.
In the case of the United States, the IMF should have taken a much stronger position, warning about the buildup of financial excess in the private economy, dangerous collateralized debt obligations, the housing bubble, completely dropped the ball on that. And unless the IMF is able to monitor the rich and powerful countries like the United States, as well as other countries, it will totally lose its credibility.
Some experts see the intimacy between the IMF and U.S. corporations as a matter of concern.
All of the big decisions at the IMF are made by the U.S. Treasury Department.
Well, even the head of the World Bank has accused the top advanced economies of hypocrisy in their policies.
When countries with large fiscal deficits preach fiscal discipline to poor countries, what are they really saying? Do what I say, not what I do. When countries pay homage to free trade, but hold back developing countries with barriers.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn, and I'm talking with Bill Fink, and also we have Frank on the phone line, and our phone number is 1-855-477-2283. When we started the break, Frank and Bill, we were kind of talking about how moral the black man can be according to white laws, and you were saying you didn't think, Bill, you were saying you didn't think he did too
well. Well, blacks fear force. The only thing they fear and respect is force. The only thing that got me out of a lot of predicaments in law enforcement and jail was the fact that I'm like 6'4 and 240, right? And blacks understand that. That they have a full comprehension of. And up until the Civil Rights Act in the mid 60s, when a black man acted up, he knew that the white cop was going to crack his head. So he didn't want to trip up the white cop. And they understand that, especially down south when they just find them hanging in trees. Now, the blacks in black communities, they have a totally different standard of behavior. They do the same things that they do in Africa, where little girls are raped at 12 years old as some sort of ritual for the boys to enter into manhood. And that's how they treat their women in Africa. And that's how they treat them in black communities here. And there's all kinds of crime, even in the 50s, even in the 40s, even in the 30s, in black communities. They're constantly robbing and raping and doing each other wrong. Today, most murders in our cities are black on black. Even though there's a great amount of black on white crime, there's still more black on black murders. And that's because, and the crime was not reported in the 40s and 50s, so we think they're moral, but they're not, because they have a great stigmatism in their own community. You can't go to Whitey. You can't go to the man and report crime that a black man did to you, because if you do that, every black man in the community is going to hate you. You are a traitor if you go report your crime to the white police. That's the way they think. Mm-hmm. So we think they're moral because there's no crime there? Well, no. They're totally immoral, and there's no crime reported there. They're always abusing each other, stealing from each other, killing each other, raping each other, but it's not reported to the man.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me while you've been talking that my idea about the blacks being more moral before the 60s and integration comes from movies and so on. And
popular
information, which shows all these nice little black poor families, you know.
It is true. I'm sorry. It is true. And the caller is right when he says that blacks had it better in a lot of ways. But that's because, especially down south, before integration, blacks were forced to go to other black businesses, right?
Yes.
So they had to support each other, but it was by compulsion. As soon as the chain was off the hook, they abandoned their own fellow blacks.
And well, look at what's happened in Africa. I mean, as long as the whites were controlling these African areas, things were one way. But when they got their freedom, when they got their independence and so on, and they put, you know, were black presidents and so on, and kings and queens and what have you, everything went chaotic there under this black rule when the white man left, right?
Well, absolutely. And that's how they treat each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, you even see you see reflections of that in this country, like Cleveland. It was the first major city that had a black mayor. His name was Carl Stokes. Cleveland, you know, mm-hmm. that was just really the beginning of Cleveland's downfall. And since then, there have been a few white mayors, but basically it's been black rule in that city. And you can see now it's one of it's fourth poorest city in the country.
Yeah, it's a mess. You know, yeah. Cleveland.
Youngstown, I was in the Ohio area for 10 years in the 90s and the first decade of the century. And in Youngstown, blacks were constantly being electrocuted trying to steal copper. It was going on all the time. I heard about it every few months practically on the radio. And they were, if you had a house and you moved out and you put the house up for sale, you would lose all the copper. You would lose all the aluminum. So, and you would lose all the ceramic. They steal everything from the house, and they do. And the businesses in Youngstown, it's worse than Cleveland in Youngstown probably, but it's a much smaller city, so we don't hear about it as much. But it's going on all over the country, and well, all they know how to.
Go ahead, Frank.
Oh, I was going to say the thing you're beginning to see now is it's so pervasive that. If you watch evening news, like in, from the major cities, you see these black groups. They get together and they're going under the banner of "We're going to take back our neighborhood" and "We're against crime." And you see 15 or 20 mothers marching along with a bunch of community activists and local black officials, and they're outraged at the crime and the violence in their communities. But they're always very careful to walk around the race issue on that. And then you'll see these be followed up by another news story about metro government, where they want a lot of these urban centers to be sort of now gerrymandered into bedroom communities to the city that are pretty much white suburbia.
Tippy-toeing around the race issue. That's what we have to do, like it or not.
There's been an active campaign the last 20 years to push the blacks out into the suburbs, at least. And they've even legislated it in New Jersey and several other states.
Yeah, look at Camden. And the thing is, too, again, not to get into the housing thing, but Barney Frank and this, again, with the easy loans, the country today, whether anybody wants to admit it or not, it's as segregated now as it ever was.
Well, that's because people naturally want to be with their own kind.
Yeah, oh, exactly. And the idea was that if you gave all of these poor blacks and non-whites easy loans that weren't based on any kind of credit score, they could move out into a nice white crime-free suburb. And it would force integration. But, I mean, the only thing it did was it collapsed the black community because all of Detroit's in foreclosure, all of Cleveland's in foreclosure, and the cities are terrible. They're trying to tear down houses, and they're out of money for the demolition of these things. The local governments are.
Well, even whites aren't going to respect what they get for free. But most white people have worked hard for their homes, and when their neighbors get a house for nothing – Well, there goes the neighborhood. That's the way it is. It's just going to disintegrate. And blacks, wherever they go, they bring Africa. That's all they can bring is Africa. That's all they have the capability of creating is Africa.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Whites have to realize this. Whites have to look at our cities. And this is why history is so important. Ancient Egypt was the greatest of white nations. It was invaded by Nubians in the 8th century BC. It's never been the same since. It had a little glimpse of civilization in the Greek period, but that was Macedonian. It wasn't Egyptian. And ancient Persia, the same thing. It was the greatest of nations. It became race mixed. It was overrun by Arabs. Then it was overrun by Mongols. And today it's Iran. There was an earthquake a few years ago in a city called Bam, B-A-M. That's really the name of the city. I'm not making it up. And 2,000-year-old mud brick structures were knocked to the ground. Well, what are they doing living in 2,000-year-old mud brick structures? Because that's all they could create.
Yeah.
And anything that's created over there now is Western oil money and the richer oil sheiks purchasing Western engineering to come over there and build something. And everything you see in the Middle East today was built by German engineers or American engineers or English engineers. None of it was, maybe some of the Arabs were some of the workers, but it's even the oil money is created an elite and the rest of the nation is still in virtual poverty. So.
Well, we need to understand, we need to accept that that we, as white people, have something that no one else has, and we need to protect it and protect ourselves no matter what. And this giving ourselves away like this and making ourselves slaves based on misunderstood Christianity to some degree, and also then just based on Jewish intrigue, but also liberal thinking, all those three things.
Well, it's Jewish intrigue that has brought us that this liberalism and that has brought us that the misunderstood Christianity. And that's one of my favorite quotes in that I've probably written this year. It is about, it is the contrasting two liberalisms. Jeffersonian liberalism held the ideal that a God-fearing Christian nation could govern itself, that people that feared God were just and moral people and governed themselves. That was the self-government idea that Jefferson was a liberal for his time, right? But it was a different kind of liberalism.
Yes. Okay.
And that therefore, because God-fearing people could govern themselves, that they don't need a tyrant in the form of a church or a monarch. And Jewish liberalism has taken God out of the nation and imposed on us a tyranny that would make either the churches or the monarch salivate. I mean, they would love to have that tyranny. And Jewish liberalism is the polar opposite of everything that Jeffersonian liberalism was, what was about.
What about this Hain Solomon?
I wanted to bring him up. He's a figure in the Philadelphia article. He's mentioned, and I also have attached to that article on a different link an article that John Tiffany wrote for the Barnes Review about Hain Solomon, and I like a lot of John Tiffany's work, right? Well, I absconded that article, and I give him credit, of course, and the Barnes Review gives people permission to reprint their articles, so that's on Christogenia with it, because it's an important article, because the Jews, that they're in Philadelphia making our revolutionary history safe for multiculturalism, safe for Muslims, safe for the Chinese, and safe for Jews. And they're rewriting history in a manner that facilitates and accommodates these aliens and facilitates this this corruption of our culture, right? Hain Solomon is a big player in this because there are monuments to him in Philadelphia. And they call him the father, the financier of the revolution. And that's a lie. It's a blatant lie. There's another Pennsylvania native named Robert Morris. And Robert Morris was the real genius and the real financier of the revolution. Hain Solomon was one of his employees. And Hain Solomon was taking securities and putting them in his own account and making himself rich off of financing the revolution. And now the Jews are giving him credit for being the financier of the revolution and claiming that he died broke.
You don't have any pictures of his monuments to him on your
there is one picture. The monument used to be outside the Jewish Museum, and we think they moved it inside because it's just gone. But the sign is there, and I wouldn't go into the Jewish Museum. I just couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. I was there with a good friend, and we couldn't go. Well, I just couldn't bring myself to. Well, when you read the signs about the searches that you're susceptible to, it's like the fear of flying, right? You don't want to deal with the TSA. And it was really crazy. It looked really
Everything the Jews have, they have to have all this super duper security.
Well, that's
so
another thing.
Of people committing violence against them.
That's another thing I'd like to mention. And it is incredible. I was at Philadelphia in 1995, and there was no security hardly. You could walk around wherever you wanted, anytime you wanted. Well, I was there this year twice. You can't get into the plaza at Independence Hall. You'd think you were trying to get into a synagogue in Palestine.
That really impressed me in this article. And you have a picture there showing how just to get into this mall in Philadelphia, which is supposed to be the center of our freedom and liberty and so on, and you have to go through this search thing, just like in the airlines.
Every bag has to get searched.
To get in there.
There's five or six guards standing there checking out everybody's pockets, looking at everybody up and down.
Terrible. That is just a perfect example of what has become of our country.
Well, and that's why Jewish liberalism, what we end up with is a tyranny. It's the end result of Jewish thinking. It's unavoidable.
It absolutely is.
But you take that a step further and take a look at public schools, in the urban areas. One area comes to mind is Shaker Heights. It's a suburb of Cleveland, primarily Jewish at one time. And in the 50s, they said it was going to become the model of integration. It was going to be what the balance of the 20th century was going to be, everybody living in harmony. I mean, you go there now, and everybody goes through a metal detector going into the high school. They've got full-time police. The place, I mean, it's really turned into a version of East Cleveland.
Okay, Frank. I thought there was another caller, but...
Yes.
Thanks, Frank, for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, bye. You're very welcome. Okay, hello, new caller.
Yes. First, I want to apologize to Bill for asking you a question and catching you off guard about Liberia. I'm just trying to research and study, and you sound really knowledgeable about the subject. I do want to mention, you know, I've noticed Christian identity, as far as religious freedom that we supposedly have in America under the First Amendment, it is the only religion that is completely infiltrated by feds. I guess a few days ago they had a Aryan Nations Congress meeting in Louisiana, and it was infiltrated by two federal agents. And they were just having a meeting. They weren't doing anything illegal. And they're always constantly being targeted by federal agents. And, you know, it saddens me that, you know, black liberation theology, all the other churches, the Latino churches, they get to do as they please. They have all the religious freedoms that they could ever ask for. Even Muslims have religious freedoms in America, just not Christian identity. They are the ones that have to act like they're sneaking around. They need to hide. They're doing something wrong. They might go to jail. And there is a serious risk of any.
Well, I would really like to respond to that. I hate to cut you short. I would really like to respond to that. Okay? First, look at who the Jews hate the most. Look at who the Jews fear the most. And that's probably where you'll find the truth.
Right.
Second.
Well, that should be
this is a damn shame. The United States government and most United States law enforcement organizations get most of their training on religion from the ADL.
Mm-hmm.
The ADL is a Jewish supremacist group, which is a portion, it's an agency of a secret society. The B'nai B'rit is a Masonic, it's a Jewish Masonic secret society. It's their full name is the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rit. You want to ask about what happened to separation of church and state? How about separation of synagogue and state?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's different.
Christian identity is racial. It's the only Christian
Christianity is racial.
System. Yeah, Christianity. It's only true Christianity that teaches about speaks about race. And so they'd be totally against that and treated as criminal.
I'm sorry. There are a couple of Christian identities that have done some bad things, right? I can't ever promote wanton violence. okay? Eric Rudolph blew up a couple of abortion clinics, perhaps. I don't know the truth, right? But that's what he's blamed to do. And he was a Christian identist, and I would never approve of that. If no matter who your enemy is, you could never, ever, wanton violence is just nothing that we're supposed to engage in, and you can never risk killing one innocent person, period. That's the way it is. Thou shalt not kill, right? Oh. Thou shalt not murder. But on the other hand, in Christian identity, there have only been a few people to do stupid things, and the ADL plays those things up. And then it takes a lot of things that other white nationalists have done, like Bob Matthews, David Tate, and a few other people, and they lump them together with Christian identity, but none of those people are Christian identity. That's ADL perfidy there. That is, they're running a misinformation campaign against Christian identity. But if you look at all the horrible things that Jews and Catholics have done, why aren't those religions blamed for those criminals?
Okay, yeah, caller. Thank you, caller. We've got one more caller waiting, and so let's try to take this last person before our time is up. Okay. Hello. Who are you? Takes so long to get the call on. Hello, caller. Nah. Well, Bill. You're waiting patiently. You know, I'm told I have a caller waiting, and then
hello?
There it is. All right. Hello.
Oh, hi. Hey. So I just want to make a quick comment about the concept of spiritual brotherhood that came up a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem we're dealing with is that concept is really intended to apply only to personal relationships between individuals, you know, who actually have a chance to get to know each other. And what we're looking at is that this concept has been misapplied to the impersonal relationship between races and population groups with all their social, political, and economic factors. And that's partly where we're running into trouble. But I don't think we need to negate the concept of spiritual brotherhood as it applies between individuals.
Those
are two completely different arenas.
Can we ask you who you are and where you're from?
Oh, my name is Chuck.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Chuck, I do understand what you're saying. However, if you examine the New Testament, you'll find instances where one is a brother or a kinsman, and they're not necessarily other Christians, right? Or at least not yet.
Right. Well, I'm just talking about the concept in general, as Jesus intended it, I think.
Well, right. But as Christ intended it, he came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel and for nobody else. And the entire New Testament is only for those people
hanging out with publicans and sinners. He was hanging out with everybody.
Well, that's because they were Israelites who were sinners.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were the people that were in the world at that time.
Publicans and sinners have nothing to do with race.
Anyway,
right?
But my point is that there's a difference between the relationship between individuals and the relationship between races and population groups. And the relationship between races and population groups should be, you know, regulated by laws and good sense and, you know, and everything that enters into that. It's not the same type of dynamic that you find between individuals. That was my... only point on that. But by the way, could you say the name of your website more slowly? I was trying to find it, and I couldn't.
It's Christogenia. It's if you really want the easy way to go there, just go to john844.com, and you'll be redirected right to Christogenia. But it's John844.
Okay.
.com. It's Christogenia is Christo. Genea.
All right.
Now, some people pronounce it Christogenia, you want to explain why you pronounce it Christogenia and why?
Because I invented the word. Well, I did. That the it's a Greek compound word, right? And the G in Greek and Latin is never soft.
Okay.
It's a hard G, It's Christogenia. It could mean a lot of things. It can mean the birth of Christ. It could mean the race of Christ. It could mean the anointed race. I coined a term, and its fellow term, Christogenos, which is a synonym, because they express all of those meanings, and so does my wealth in Shang or my outlook on life express all of those things as important, and all of those things are components of my writing and my website.
All right. Well, thanks for the clarification.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye, Chuck. Thanks for calling, Chuck. Well, we are about at the end here. We might have about 30 seconds to go. Well, here's the music. I want to thank you so much, Bill Fink, for coming on the program tonight. I think it's been very interesting, and I hope we'll have you again.
Well, thank you for having me, and praise Christ.
All right.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.